Hello and welcome to the Oxford Sidebar podcast for September from the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association. Our speaker this month is Professor Peter Atkins, who spoke to us about his book On Being. So without any further ado, here's the talk. So this is Peter Atkins, was former professor of chemistry at Oxford University. He's written a number of books, not the least of which is Physical Chemistry for the Chemists Amongst Us, which has got a number of my friends through their undergrads at least, and Galileo's Finger, but he's here tonight to talk about his second most recent book, On Being, which is has the tagline of a scientist's exploration of the great questions of existence. And his newest book, which was out last Thursday, is called Reactions, the Private Life of the Atom. And so without any further ado, I'll hand you over to Peter.
Is that all right? It's lovely to be here. I'm going to talk around this book, this little book, which, as you heard, is really about great questions of existence. It's such a short book, I thought I could actually read it from cover to cover in the 20 minutes that I've got, but I'll actually flesh it out a bit. My reason for writing it was really to show the way that science has displaced myth. And myth, of course, is a wonderful entertainment that you can have a good laugh at some of the myths that have sort of pervaded civilization for the past several thousand years. And some people are deluded into thinking that the myths are actually true. But of course, they're just a sign that people were very concerned about answers to deep questions like, the purpose of the universe and what happens after you die and so on. My view is that science is on the track of providing answers to all the deep questions that have troubled humanity since it began to think about things. I'll go further than that, maybe just to be really non-controversial, I suppose, in a way. I think that science is the only way of answering any real question about the nature of the world. There are many people, of course, who think that it looks at one side of questions and that the other side, the spiritual side, is answered by various religions. I think that's nonsense. I think that this extraordinarily potent mechanism that mankind has stumbled on, the scientific method, is capable of exploring and in due course answering in a comprehensible way everything that has troubled humanity since it grew up. And the scientific method, by the scientific method I simply mean not thinking about what the world should be like, but going out and seeing what it is actually like. And then talking to other people, that is, comparing notes, making sure that your ideas fit into the network of knowledge that people are establishing. So, and of course it's done in alliance with mathematics, which puts people off often, but mathematics is that sort of very harsh language, free of passion, wonderful in itself, where you can, once you've formulated an idea in terms of mathematics, you can pursue in a dispassionate way the consequences. It's really a wonderful component of the scientific method. So I thought I would just mention the great ideas that I think trouble mankind. And I mean, there's lots of little ideas like, what's my next job and things like that. But the big questions where I can, I think, show that science is moving towards an answer. And one of the biggest ideas, I think, biggest problems is, where it all came from and why we got a universe. And that immediately raises a problem. I believe, and I'm happy to take this up in the discussion afterwards, that no valid question begins with why. There is no such thing as a serious why question. The only questions that there are is how. So, for example, why is it raining? Is not really a sensible question. What you should say is, how does it come to be that it is raining? So you could always deconstruct why questions into how questions. And the how questions are ones that science is equipped to answer. So you could accuse me, I suppose, of saying that there's a lot of questions out there that I can't answer, therefore I say that they're nonsense questions. That's true, and I will defend that position if you push me on it later on. You know, so why is there a universe? Seems to me to be a nonsense question. But how did it come to be that there is a universe is a seriously intelligent question that has certainly, you know, troubled people and has troubled philosophers and is currently troubling scientists. Of course, the difference between philosophers' approach to questions like that and scientists' approach to questions is that philosophers are professional pessimists, and so they say that there are no questions, there are no answers to questions like that. Whereas scientists, of course, are professional optimists. They set out on their journey into the unknown by expecting to answer the questions that they ask. Never listen to a philosopher. I mean, if you're in a state of depression, then philosophers will drive you deeper and deeper into it. If you're in a state of optimism, then they will simply undermine you. Listen only to scientists. So scientists are the, in this world you need optimists. We scientists are optimistic for good reason. And if you want to take up why we're optimistic, then you know, that's an opening for you later on. So how does it come to be that there is a universe is one of the questions that I attack in this book. And of course no one knows. But what I tried to do is that show that science is edging towards an answer that in due course will be comprehensible. Some people would think that the answer, God did it, is comprehensible. I regard that as just an intellectual deceit, so I'm not interested in answers like that. But what the way that science is moving towards answering deep questions like that is in two directions. First of all, it's, as everyone here knows, sort of driving backwards in time to look at the very early universe. Not just 1900, but you know, 1/1,000,000,000th of a second after the universe came into existence, to see what it looked like immediately after it was formed. And we're very confident, of course, about the history of the universe from a few seconds after it was formed. And with decreasing confidence, cosmologists, in collaboration with some particle physicists and theoreticians, are edging back towards a barrier that where our current laws of physics seem to break down. But that's extraordinarily exciting, because knowing what the universe looked like 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, must have happened before it was formed. But the other way is to ask what had to be made in order to make a universe. So you can see that a lot of energy had to be made, because you know, the universe is sort of crammed full of energy. Think of everything. I mean, we pay a lot for it, so there must be a lot for it. But the universe is full of energy. And so where did that energy come from? Wherever it came from, it remained the same as soon as the universe was created, because energy, the total amount of energy never changes. So whoever decided to make the universe and to trust mankind with a certain amount of energy decided that there had to be that amount on at the incipients. A deep problem, worrying problem. How can all that energy be created? What science does is to look into that question to see whether it actually can be simplified. And if it can be simplified, then maybe it can have an answer. So what a scientist would do is to say, yeah, there's a lot of energy. Let's count it. Let's see how much energy there is really in the universe. So we'll have a figure. And the way you do that is to weigh the universe. Because through E equals mc squared, I've allowed one formula this evening, E equals mc squared. If you know the mass of the universe, then you multiply by the square of the speed of light and you get the energy. So what you do, you go out and weigh a galaxy, it's easy enough to do, multiply it by c squared, weigh another galaxy, multiply by c squared, and add up all these contributions. And you obviously get an absolutely colossal energy. And so at this point, you say, my goodness, that took a lot of effort. But then, because you're a scientist, you say, have I accommodated everything? Have I taken into account all the contributions to the energy? And one contribution that to the energy is the gravitational attraction between galaxies. You know, this galaxy attracts that galaxy. It's why the whole universe hangs together effectively. And when a galaxy attracts another galaxy, it lowers their energy a little bit. And this galaxy is interacting with that galaxy, so it's lowered a bit more. And if you do the sum, it looks as though, and this is a speculation, but it's a speculation that seems to be becoming verified, then the lowering of energy caused by the attraction between all the galaxies takes that original huge colossal energy we had all the way down to zero. So the correct answer to how much energy there is in the universe appears to be zero. Now once you realize that, the question about where did all that energy come from is greatly simplified. There isn't any, so it didn't have to come from anywhere. And so that's what science has done, is really to simplify the kind of question that focuses on truth, if you like. And you immediately see that if energy didn't have to be made, then the question of where it all came from gets much simpler. And the prospect is that a description of the emergence of the universe out of absolutely nothing becomes within range. And that's why I think that science is moving towards being able to answer the question about the origin of the universe, how something could come from absolutely nothing. And it's, you know, a very exciting sort of prospect. Once you've got the universe, of course, it can grow into complexity. And one of the ways that it grows into complexity is by allowing organisms to emerge in it. And so, you know, one of the great myths of creation, if you like, was the origin of animals and the biosphere in general. But that was swept away by Darwin's wonderful ideas about natural selection. We have to admit that we still don't know how the inorganic made that first transition into the organic, how life first emerged, the first replicating molecule, if you like, distant, very, very distant ancestor. But it doesn't mean to say that we'll never know, and scientists have got lots of ideas about how it actually took place. It's just that they don't have the evidence to decide between them. I mean, if someone proposed that God created Adam and Eve and that was that, then some people would fall for that. But scientists who say that an RNA molecule formed somehow, the scientists don't fall for that. They wait for evidence, and they wait for knowing how it could happen, given the conditions on the planet at the time that it occurred. And we simply don't know that in sufficient detail. So, but once life gets underway, I think it's inevitable that it proceeds by natural selection and various modifications of natural selection to lead to us. And indeed, I think it's the case that if you were to go to any planet in the universe where life existed, then it would have evolved by natural selection. I like to think that there are certain ideas in science that have great nobility, because we scientists are effectively hewers of simplicity out of complexity. We see the world around us in all its amazing, glorious complexity, but we know that that complexity springs from extraordinarily simple seeds of ideas. And I think the great ideas of science are the ones which are extremely simple but have great potency. And natural selection, I think, is almost the best example of that. The idea of natural selection, the competition between species for resources, is so simple, yet as you unfurl it, so it takes into account the existence of the entire biosphere. It's a wonderful, I think. So I talk a little bit about that. I don't talk about the processes of evolution in the book, but I talk about what it means in the context of understanding the nature of the world. I think I won't spend as much time on other things. I talk about hereditary. I mean, the most important discovery of the 20th century, of the second half of the 20th century, was, of course, the structure of DNA, because all the medicine and understanding and forensic implications of the discovery of the structure of DNA. But you can see that nature was caught in a bind, in the sense that the DNA is made up, as I imagine most people know, of four bases which sort of wrap around a double helix. And so it's a four-letter code for imparting structural information from one generation to the next. So nature has lighted upon this extraordinarily simple code, but then got into a fix of how to interpret it. And one of the problems with giving birth, some of you here will know maybe, is the complexity of the processes involved in getting the information out of that four-letter code and turn it into a human being. And it's an extraordinarily complex process. And it's almost miraculous. But it's not quite miraculous. It is, of course, scientific. And what I do is to try to show how nature has resolved the problem of getting information, sufficient information out of a strand of DNA and that four-letter code and turn it into a human being. Life, I talk about. I won't talk about the second law of thermodynamics now, but we'll be happy to. I regard it as the most... after natural selection, the law of science, which has given us the deepest understanding about why anything happens in the world. So I regard it as a very important thing. But let me just pursue life for a little bit. Consciousness. I mean, if I'm giving advice to someone going into science about the big problems that they should perhaps devote their life to solving, I think I could think of two. I've dismissed devoting your life to doing titrations and things like that. But you know, what are the really big questions of worth a lifetime's endeavour? One I've already mentioned, the origin of the universe. The other is the nature of consciousness. And what can science say about the nature of consciousness? And how will it go about providing an understanding of it? Whereas the understanding of the origin of the universe will boil down to a mathematical formula. No problem. But that won't be the case with something so subtle as consciousness. And I think that the way that science will edge forward to understand the nature of consciousness is to simulate it using a variety of computers, not necessarily digital computers, but you know, fancy computers of some kind. And in due course, and we're already seeing signs that this is becoming possible, computers that are indistinguishable in some respects from human thought thinkers will become available, no doubt about that. And once you've got computers that think and have a sense of self, then you could do interesting experiments. They probably will form the view that you're God because you've made them, but that's a hazard for the future. I think what will be left for philosophers and scientists to do is to resolve whether the consciousness that is manifest by computers is in fact the same as our own consciousness, which our own consciousness, of course, is a remnant of our evolutionary history, so deep questions will come from there. Death I talk about my own death, actually. I thought this was rather gruesome. I just like reading that chapter because it brings me close with my non-maker. But I do talk about the understanding of death that science has achieved. Mainly the physical and biochemical processes that result that follow death, but also the implications for an afterlife. And of course, science can readily dismiss that prospect of an afterlife, that supreme weapon of crowd control. And I'm happy to talk about that if you want me to. I admit that there can be immortality, but it's immortality of, it might be the immortality of Mozart through his music, the immortality of Newton through his physics, and the immortality of Tutankhamun through tourism. I'm happy with the imprint of immortality of one's imprint on society, but nothing else. And science can, without doubt, really say that there is no prospect of any afterlife. Carpe diem, in other words. But you can also talk about the death of the solar system. And we can be pretty clear about what's going to happen to the solar system over the next few billion years. You know, the sun's going to swell up to a red giant, and we on the Earth will be more or less a cinder in orbit around it, and all our aspirations and constructions will have gone. Doesn't mean to say that it's not worth doing anything today, of course, but that's a question of personal purpose we could also talk about if you want to do. The prospect of understanding in the long term, and I mean the really long term, trillions and trillions of trillions and trillions of years into the future is still problematic, because it may be that we've constructed our physical laws by looking at 300 years from events, basically. So what happens on them? Are we justified in extrapolating physical laws built by extrapolation from our laboratories to trillions and trillions and trillions of years in the future? No one knows, of course. It could be that, currently people think that the three dimensions of space are in fact a ruse, a kind of simplification of what it really is, and it's much more likely to be 10 dimensions of space. It's just that we can't detect the other seven. But could it be that those other dimensions will gradually unfurl and become apparent on a time scale of trillions and trillions and trillions of years? No one knows. The mathematical theory of the origin of the universe will enable us to predict that, whether it happens or not, but we're not there yet. So, the future is unknown, but that's part of the excitement. I think what science has done has been to provide an extraordinarily brilliant illumination of questions that have troubled people, continue to trouble people, as they migrate from their cradle to their grave. And it does so, in my view, without diminishing wonder. I think that's really an important thing. You might say, the scientific reduction of the universe to a few principles and takes all the magic out of it. Absolutely not. I think it adds an extraordinary wonder to our understanding of the world, that we can begin to understand what it is like. And I think that really gives joy. I mean, scientists perhaps are not renowned for being joyous, but what they are really doing is discovering understanding, and in my view, understanding adds joy to being alive. And I'll stop there.
If anyone's got any questions, if you want to just pop your hand up and pull you out of this. Gentleman over there.
You describe consciousness as being a remnant of our evolution. Could you elaborate on that? I haven't heard that phrase before.
Yeah, did I say that? I can never remember what I said, actually. But, I said that although we might build a computer which had all the appearances of some kind of consciousness, it might not coincide with our own consciousness, because our own consciousness, the structure of our brains and the way we think, has emerged through our evolutionary history. It's been modelled by our experiences through the generations. And so you might say, a part of consciousness is aesthetics. And so would this computer have the same aesthetic senses as we have? Would it be able to look, for example, at a female body and say, beautiful? When we do that, it's probably because we look at its potential for reproduction and think, beautiful, if it looks viable. So if a computer hasn't gone through that process, we could build it in, of course, but if it hasn't gone through that process, it wouldn't think that a woman's body was necessarily beautiful.
It was more that your use of the word remnant suggests that it's a byproduct or a...
Did I say remnant? Let me withdraw the word remnant. That's the best way of dealing with questions. I think sort of an aspect of it, which I think does sort of build on what you've just asked, is whether science can illuminate ethics, whether science can probe the difference between good and evil, for example. And in my view, and I talk about the possibility in the book, if that is possible, because to understand one's current behaviour, one needs to see how the infrastructure of decisions have grown up through our evolutionary history. But the way that red in tooth and claw can be modulated by the milk of human kindness, of being able to think about the consequences of our actions because of our big brains and so on. So I think science can illuminate ethical questions in due course. And indeed it's beginning to through sort of functional MRI, looking at the way people take decisions.
Gentlemen. So if I had a youth office, there's only a national park, picking around with some Christian friends about myth-making, and we look at these vast mountains around us, and we think the thousands of billions of millions throughout the world, just like this, and if all the roads are missing, we're much, much more than the people. Yes, I find that hard to...
But it's true. But that's what's so amazing.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes, it was. The question was concerned that there's, in short, that there's a huge universe which somehow emerged from a pea, something the size of a pea. You have to be careful about the Big Bang. The universe was never the size of a pea. And the universe was always, even when the instant it was first formed, was infinitely big and infinitely dense. It's just that our bit of the universe that we can now see was the size of the pea. The universe is bigger than you think.
But, I understand that it's probably the best we got, but it does seem extraordinary.
Yeah, but it does extraordinary. And I think part of science, the part of the scientific method is to overcome prejudices and often to turn explanations upside down. That it, you go into the farmyard and you see things happening around you, and you see, for example, that you need to keep pushing a cart in order to move it through mud. So you draw the conclusion, as Aristotle did, that as an object remains in a state of motion because it's constantly subjected to a force. Newton comes along and says, Galileo, whichever, no, absolutely rot. The natural state of motion is, just things go on forever unless a force acts. It's the mud that's slowing you down, not your pushing that you have to think about. So it's the ability of science to invert common understanding. And then as soon as it's inverted, it becomes part of common sense. I think you'll need to shout through my microphone.
Thank you. Talking about changing understanding and things like that, what's your take on multiverse interpretation of quantum mechanics?
Sorry, I think that, I'm not going to go into detail, happily, but I think that quantum mechanics is a great simplification of our understanding. What Newton did, and the classical physicists, was to say that you could describe matter in terms of where it was and its momentum. What Heisenberg did was to say, you've got to choose. Either you talk in terms of positions of particles, or you talk in terms of their momenta. And I think that's a great simplification. It's like Newton's position, it's like starting a sentence in German and ending it in English. You muddle up two languages. Heisenberg, quantum mechanics solution, is to say, you've got to choose which language you're using. You're using English, okay, complete your sentence in English. But equally well, you can get your sense across by talking German. So you can talk in terms of memento if you wanted to. But you've got to not mix the two languages. So in a certain sense, and not in every sense, I think that quantum theory greatly simplified people's appreciation of the world. It confused it in other ways, of course.
I was referring to those confusions because there are like two interpretations, dominant interpretations. One of it is quite confusing. I'm talking about the multi-word interpretation. Yeah.
This is not an evening on quantum theory. You had that from Jim Baggett last time. So I'll back away from going into that. I'm happy to talk to you afterwards.
Any more questions? Yeah, just a question about consciousness. I mean, it seems to me that if we didn't have language, if we weren't able to consider counterfactuals, then we wouldn't be able to say to appreciate beauty is to appreciate non-beauty, which is a counterfactual to the situation. Now, in that case, the investigation of consciousness, surely it's going to be an investigation of language, which is very strange in that every time you speak, you're making something out of nothing.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I don't think, for example, the appreciation of music necessarily depends upon language. And I don't think necessarily that identifying a chord rather than a dissonance depends upon the use of language. I think it's probably to do with the structure of brains and such like. So I agree that there are regions of the appreciation of beauty that do depend on language. But I didn't see why a computer, I think it's rather a trivial task for a computer to acquire a language. You see, you're being a philosopher, you're being pessimistic.
Could you explain a bit more your idea about there being no net energy in the universe?
Let me talk about there being no electric charge. We know there's electric charge. We know that there's positive charges and negative charges, and they more or less hold atoms together. But how much charge is there in the universe? If you add up all the positive charge and add up all the negative charge, they cancel. Exactly. We know that because if they didn't cancel, if there was more positive charge than negative charge, then the universe would be blasted apart because the force of repulsion is so strong. So at the creation, before the creation, when there was nothing, there was presumably no electric charge. After the creation, there is still no net electric charge, but it's all separated into two more interesting aspects of nothing.
But there's no negative energy.
No. Think of, go back to the actual question you asked. Then when you've got two bodies that are attracting each other, perhaps gravitationally, then the closer they are together, the lower their energy. And so what I was asserting as a speculation, but as a speculation that is getting more believable as time goes on, especially since the discovery of dark matter, that lowering of energy lowers that big sum we have from E equals mc squared all the way down to zero.
So there was no mass in the universe?
Yeah. Mass is just a measure of energy. Mass is energy divided by c squared. There's nothing funny about mass. It's just localized energy. Are you convinced now? Well, it depends which multiverse you mean. Well, there are various multiverses. It is one solution to the fact that the universe seems to be so finely tuned to human existence is that it's just one of an infinite number of universes, all of which sort of tumbled into being for some reason. And it's not surprising that one of them, or perhaps an infinite number of them, turns out to have the right mix of fundamental constants.
That's a scientific explanation.
Well, that's a very... if you've got a model, if you've got a theory of the emergence of universes, then and it's made rendered mathematical, then, and it has that prediction, then you can begin to believe it. I'm not saying you must believe it, but you can at least begin to believe it. So the fine-tuning argument, which is really what you're touching on, is, I think, easily solved by there being an infinite number of universes.
Do we have any more questions?
Yes.
I'll take one from everyone.
You said that the second law of thermodynamics is one of the most important laws. Why do you think that?
Because it explains everything. Yeah. Second law of thermodynamics says that things get worse. Plenty of evidence for that around. Read your daily newspaper. But in the process of a local region of the universe getting worse, that is, energy matter spreading in disorder, if you can link into that dispersal, then maybe you can drive the emergence of structure somewhere else. So, for example, if you've got the engine in your car, when the fuel burns, the hydrocarbon molecules split up into water and carbon dioxide, and they disperse, and the energy that is released also disperses. The pistons and the cogs and all that stuff link into that dispersal. They capture it, if you like. And then you might be able to use that dispersal to drive the raising of bricks into a cathedral. So you can actually build a structure. When you have breakfast, much the same thing happens, that the food that you digest and then metabolized disperses in smaller fragments, and the energy disperses as well and is used in various ways in the body. But instead of having a series of pistons and cogs, unless you've got prosthetics, which I can't see, the metabolic processes going on inside you might be able to take not bricks but amino acids and join them together to form a protein. So as you eat, so you grow. And you can take that a little bit more fancifully, but actually it's true. Once again, breakfast, driving stuff. In your brain, before you asked your question, there were a lot of random currents, electric currents and synaptic currents, chemicals going across joints between the neurons. But the process of this dispersal can be linked through the various physiological mechanisms to turning those currents into a more coherent form. So you ask your question. So you can see how the second law, which elucidates this connection between dispersal somewhere and the emergence of structure somewhere else, accounts for, everything is an exaggeration, but vast numbers of processes going on in the universe. I think it's deeply regrettable that people go to their graves without knowing the second law of thermodynamics. It's all those ignorant corpses really trouble me. It elucidates so much.
Can you extend that to talk about how the universe began from zero energy into...
That's a real tricky one.
Structured energy.
Yeah. I mean, it really is it's troublesome. The cosmological discussions of the role of entropy are really tricky. Is it you? Sorry, I don't know who's asking. I don't want to go into that, but broadly speaking, it's related to the expansion of the universe, giving more room for disorder to emerge.
We'll take one more question from the gentleman down here.
Could you say a bit more about questions of personal purpose and morality?
The position that maybe got lost in what I was saying is that the universe does not have a purpose. I see no sign of the universe having a purpose. And as I see no sign of it, I think it has none. It does, no explanation of what goes on in the universe needs the universe to be there for a purpose. I think it's rather diminishing of the universe to think it's there for a purpose. I think it's much better that it's just this vast thing is just hanging there purposelessly. I think that's a rather wonderful vision, I think. But that doesn't mean to say that we here on Earth during our brief moments of light do not have purposes, because you've got to fill in the days, basically. And we're all motivated by all kinds of social pressures, personal pressures, and whatever. So personal purpose, driven by the second law, ultimately, is and manifests through, you know, the conditioning we've gone through, the way that we relate to other people, is a real thing. It's a physiological phenomenon, and by physiological I also mean mental, because mental phenomena are merely physiological phenomena. Not quite sure whether I'm getting to the heart of what you were asking. What was my purpose coming here this evening? Well, I mean, it's fun. I like, as I think the organisers of these events like, scientific attitudes to be dispersed through the populace. And I also like the opportunity to share my own insights, such as they are, or share my same pleasures, my kind of understanding with other people. So those are the purposes for being here this evening.
So you're happy with the idea that we should all do what we like to do?
No, because we are really is. Sorry, I've forgotten the second half of your question. The emergence of morality and understanding the origin of morality. Well, I think, as I said in my introduction, that it's a question of being under evolutionary, ethological theory of behaviour, evolutionary control, that we have grown up through the generations responding to our environment, and that has left an indelible structure on the way that we respond to events. But it isn't just that, because we're not just cockroaches. We are very elaborate cockroaches who can reflect upon the consequences of our actions. That is an important component of morality. But then you have to say, well, can science say more than just that? And I think science can, through its foot soldiers, psychology, anthropology, or the other ologies that you might, sociology. So I think, you know, science, provided you accept that science can penetrate through the skull and examine what goes on inside people's brains in a social context, then I think science can illuminate it. It's certainly better, I think, to look for illumination of that kind than to look into a holy book and to look for the rules. That seems to me to be a sterile way of trying to understand what is good and what is wrong.
Okay, I think we'll leave it there, people. Just join me in another round of applause, please. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Details of our upcoming events can be found on our website at www.oxfordsidebar.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @OxfordSidebar and on Facebook. Search for the British Science Association Oxfordshire Branch. Thanks very much.